An Evening at the Movies is a proud member of the I Did Not Make These Rankings podcast network. Other shows in the network include Masturbators, The Sip List, Crushgasm, Love is Black, Men Are the Prize, Crime Rewind, and Literature Reapers. You can find out all about our shows and more at IDNMTRpodcastnetwork.com. Happy listening. You are now entering the world of a movie review. A world full of drama, joy, ridicule, movie spoilers, unpopular opinions, and adult humor for as far as the eye can see. Welcome to An Evening at the Movies.
Good evening, wonderful viewers of An Evening at the Movies. In lieu of my standard introduction, I feel it would be better suited for this film to read two quotes. The first by Theodore Redke. In a dark time, the eyes begin to see. And one by Octavio Paz. The ancients had visions. We have television. The civilization of the spectacle is cruel. The spectators have no memory, and because of that, they lack remorse or even true conscience, and quickly forget, and scarcely blink at the scenes of death and destruction. The Persian Gulf, the curves of Madonna, the movements of Michael Jackson, they mean nothing. They await the great yawn, anonymous and universal, which is the apocalypse and final judgment of the society of spectacle. We are condemned to this next version of hell, of those who appear on screen and those who just watch. Is there an escape? I don't know. One must seek it.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite movie-based, review-based, all the bases covered podcast, An Evening at the Movies. I am your incredibly excited host to be here, and I'm not going to lie, at the end of the day, that is probably the deepest way of introducing an episode of An Evening at the Movies we've ever had before. And at the same time, it's fitting for the movie that we're here to discuss today, because, before we get to that movie and revealing the name, obviously, we have the traditional rigmarole that we have to get through. You guys know the drill, you know, movie-based podcast, stale popcorn, watered-down sodas, all our favorite movies and why we love them. You know, it is what it is. You know, we're happy to be here. We're excited to be bringing you a brand new episode. And as well, I'm joined by everybody's favorite. Wait, I have to remember when these are coming up. Okay, so this will come out after that episode. So everybody, one of everybody's favorite members of the Horror Squad, Mr. Chancey Greif, is here with us. Welcome back, Chance the Rapper.
Hi.
I knew it was coming. I would just wait for it. So, we are here for, like I said, an amazing in-depth discussion on a movie that poses a lot of questions that need to be brought up and discussed. I feel like doesn't matter if it was 30 years ago when this movie came out, or if it's 30 years later when we're finally sitting down to talk about it. A lot of this stuff is going to be relevant to today's society, and it was still relevant 30 years ago when the movie was made. So, with all of that said, we're going to be discussing the Oliver Stone highly underrated classic, Natural Born Killers. So I am excited for this episode because I have loved this movie since I first saw it when it came out on VHS. And I am excited to sit down and actually have somebody to talk about it with. And as we all know, Chansey loves to talk about the weird and the creepy and the, all of that. And this movie encompasses so much of that all into one nice little two hour and 15 minute bundle of what the fuck.
I think that's the theatrical version. Oh. I think the, is that the extended version?
Well, either way, however you want to look at it, theatrical or extended, you know, 2 hours, 2 hours, 15 minutes, 2.5 hours. It's all
back then. That was a long time.
Yeah, especially, well, we're going to get into it with this movie. We really are, because there's so much that we can discuss and should discuss. But yet, at the same time, with our normal running time, I'm not 100% sure we're going to get to it all, because there's so much stuff to discuss with this movie. But before we can get to that point, for those of you who don't know, again, spoiler alerts will be abound throughout this entire episode. So if you have not seen Natural Born Killers, we highly recommend you put a pin in this episode, go watch the movie, and come back and finish this episode of An Evening at the Movies, because this is a movie that needs to be watched, not listened to, or listened to a discussion about, in my opinion. So go unfortunately, the shitty part is you're going to have to spend $3.99 to watch it, because it's not available to stream for free anywhere. But it's definitely worth $3.99. We'll get to the rest of the review portion of that when we get to the review portion of the show. But this movie is definitely worth the $3.99 to watch. So it may not be worth it to see it a second time if you're overly sensitive to violence and all of that. But it's definitely, as it fits in our theme for the current period of time that we're in, movies that everybody should see once in their lifetime. So, back to the beginning of the background information, though. August 26, 1994, Natural Born Killers was brought to us by the controversial mind of one Oliver Stone. It was released by Warner Brothers Pictures, had a $34 million budget, made $119 million at the box office, and for inflation purposes, that translates to about $228.9 million today. And like I said, it's not available anywhere. You're going to have to pay $3.99 to watch it. So before we let the amazing Chance the Rapper try and describe the mind fuck that is the plot of this movie, sir, would you like to wager a guess as to what you think the Rotten Tomato score is?
So, if this question was to be based around like release time, I would be like, oh, 20% or less. I would guarantee it. If it was back at release time, I would guarantee a 20% or less tomato meter. But with this being, you know, because it is what a lot of people would call a cult classic. But I still don't think it gets quite as much love as it deserves. I'm going to go straight down the middle. I'm going to go with like 50%. I'm going to go right straight down the middle.
You are getting better at this game, I have to say, sir.
Why? What is it now?
You weren't spot on, but you were only off by 2%.
Over or under? Nice!
48% was the Rotten Tomato score.
Huh. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I figured it would be something. It had to be something close to half. It had to be middle. I mean, it, like I said, it's a very, there aren't too many like, oh, it's like Frailty. Either you love it or you hate it. There's never a, oh, it's okay. Nah, this movie's very.
That was kind of sort of the point I was making with the whole, it's something everybody should see once in their life. But
absolutely.
Some people, it may not be something they want to see a second time.
Yeah.
Because
that's true.
Definitely not everybody's cup. Not everybody's cup of tea. Like, I can guarantee you, Shanna would love this movie because Shanna has a
fucking yeah.
Shanna loves Frailty. Shanna loves Requiem for a Dream. Shanna loves The Departed. You know, Chancey Greif does not like Requiem for a Dream.
No.
Chancey Greif has said he will come on an evening at the movies for any movie that we do, but Requiem for a Dream.
I would always, like, if you asked me to come on for Requiem, I would do it, but I wouldn't watch it. I would simply be there as like color commentary for a wrestling match based on the way I felt about it from when I first watched it and all the fucking, and just literally life-changing events that happened within. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's one of those movies that I haven't seen yet, but I'm basing when I see it off of the stuff that I've heard. And I haven't heard spoilers, but I'm, you know, gauging like your reaction, Amanda's reaction, blah, 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 blah. And I'm not in any rush to see it. So if anybody requests it, it'll get put on the schedule, but
it may I have to give it its flowers. I have to give it its flowers. Like, a lot of the reason why I dislike the movie is because I have a serious phobia of needles, and that's prevalent in the film. And
I didn't used to be that way until I saw Saw 2. After Saw 2, when
that needle pit. Oh man,
yeah, when she gets thrown in the needle pit. Nope, I was done.
But outside of that, though, like the premise of the film, everything else about the film is it's definitely art. You can definitely put it in the art category. It's just that for me, I mean, it's like, oh my God, I can't handle that. I just can't handle this right now. Especially the time in my life when I watched it. Right. Definitely not. Not the same. Not the same.
All right. So we went off on a brief little tangent there.
That's okay.
Bringing it back in. Would you like to make an attempt at trying to describe the plot of this movie for our listeners who are not going to follow directions and continue to listen instead of going and watching this movie?
So I think I got a good idea as to how to describe this film without even really going into a lot of it. We can still do that, but I really think I got a good idea here.
Oh, I can do it. So, in like, words, I can guarantee you. Fucked up.
Okay, you're not wrong. But imagine, if you will, there was like a stained glass painting, if you will, of all the characters: Mickey Mallory, the cop, the warden, Robert Downey Jr.'s, you know, Gale.
Yeah,
whatever his name is. He's a terrible person. All these people, you get them all in this thing, and then you just drop it on the floor, and it just spider webs out. That's essentially what this movie is. It's like Pulp Fiction before Pulp Fiction, Pulp Fiction, because it covers the before on Mickey and Mallory, which are the main two characters, star-crossed lovers that are essentially based off of some dude from the 50s. I don't remember what his name is off the top of my head. But there was a similar guy who picked up a girl and they killed her family, and then she then turned around and said that he kidnapped her, but she was in on the shtick. But then it talks about, you know, like the officer, the cop, the detective on the chase for the violent criminals. then the subsequent, you know, what happens after they get caught and incarcerated, and then it goes into the politicized nature of the media portrayal, then devolves into chaotic anarchy at the end, which then comes full circle by them killing their own demons.
That's probably the best way that you could put it. There's still veiled spoilers throughout that entire description, but it's not like they're blatant spoilers that are, you know, just sitting there slapping the listeners in the face.
If they're not going to listen to directions, then they're going to have to get further into the recording to actually get the real good spoilers.
Yeah, because I'm not going to lie, at this point, I have, I think, 4 discussion questions, and I'm sure in the wealth of notes that
my 4 pages
has as well, that there'll be more that gets brought up as well. But I'm not even going to go to the traditional cookie cutter questions that we have just yet to start off with, because I feel like you guys know that those are coming. So we'll get to those at the end of my portion of the discussion. But I mean, at this point, let's just rip the Band-Aid off and go for it.
I'm down. Let's do it.
What statement is Oliver Stone making with this picture? And does he go too hard with that statement?
So I'm going to answer the second question first. And I'm going to say no, he didn't.
I would agree
because of how mundane what was released at the time, which was so controversial at that time, is now just yawn, next. That's all it is now.
And at the same time, we also need to remember to listeners that this movie was borderline NC-17 when it was released.
155 cuts.
Yes. There was a lot of cuts that had to be made for...
Exactly 155.
So, needless to say, this movie, 1, almost didn't get released. 2, was so severe that, like Chancey said, it had to have 155 cuts made.
Yep, the MPAA demanded it. Yep.
To get a low enough rating to where it could be shown in theaters. That is how graphic this movie was. That is how tough and dark the subject matter is that they went with for this story.
Okay. And as explained by Oliver Stone, the most common complaint given by the MPAA was, I don't know what it is about this, but it bothers me, or it bothers us, because of the general atmosphere is so chaotic.
Yes. It's fucking chaos from opening credits to closing credits in this movie.
Yeah.
The roller coaster ride does not ever stop. It doesn't even, I personally don't even think it slows down at any point. It's just up, down, back, forth, side, diagonal.
I would say that the closest thing that we would come to it is the desert scene. That's almost like the great, you know, you take that breath out because you've been holding your breath for so long, you take that breath out and then you take that deep breath in before that scream at the pharmacy. And then basically from that point on, it's just fucking insanity. It's all insanity. But it just progressively gets worse.
Even that desert scene is insanity. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. But Well, yeah. Yeah. The
desert scene is probably the one moment that you will get where you can release your breath and catch your breath again before
you
hit that final all over the place. And, you know, I'm coasting in, you know, with no breaks to the closing credits.
I agree. Like, even starting with the opening sequence, there's some things that you can tell that the director, like, and this is also coming from having watched it a bunch of times with and with, you know, on my own and with the commentary after getting the special edition or whatever. But, like, there's a lot of things that you don't really kind of pick up on until after your first or second time watching it. Like, case in point, when the waitress is talking to Mickey about the key lime pie, it's in color, and then it flashes to gray, and then this whole other thing starts to happen. Like, it's this overt flirtation, and then it goes back to normal in the color scheme. So you can tell that, okay, well, the gray is her delusion. And that's almost kind of the way it is with a lot of it, in the gray and the parts of black and white where a lot of the things are going on is when some of the most delusional or surreal things happen, like the following the knife through the window when they're all trying to get away and all that other nonsense. It's just, yeah. And then, I mean, it's literally just so, and also, like, if you pay close attention at the very beginning, when in another gray scene, as they're in the black and white, you know, panning across the diner, we see the dude who saves the day in the shower at the prison scene later on in a booth having food for a nanosecond, and then he fades out. Mm-hmm. It's
therein lies the beauty of what Oliver Stone does with this movie is. Fucks with the boundaries between reality and delusion. Like, he's Picasso painting, you know, a masterpiece on the canvas.
Yeah. Yeah, my note actually put it down is that it acts as a surreal accent to reality.
Yeah.
And then...
And I almost kind of sort of want to say that that aspect of it may be one of the reasons why some people, if that's not your cup of tea, may not be down for the movie, because it kind of plays with that psychological element that.
And they don't know which side of the fence to stand on to view it from anyway.
Exactly.
I totally could get that. I totally could get that.
Well, and again, that's like the whole subject matter of the movie, though, too, because there's very much a sensationalism to the elements of Mickey and Mallory and the way that the media portrays them and handles them throughout the whole entire movie. And I mean, obviously, that's a statement that Stone is going after with making this movie, and I don't even feel like I'm even doing his quote-unquote statement justice by the way I'm describing it. But
I was gonna say, that's all right. I got you covered, man. I'm gonna come in with the cleanup, and we're gonna sweep that shit right up, because I got you.
Okay, well then, on that note, the statement that Oliver Stone is making, in the words of Chancey Greif, take one.
Action. Yeah, right. So, like, the one of the biggest things that you'll notice right out the gate is the usage of the like when there is color and it's not blood or, you know, explosions or whatever. Mm-hmm. Green. Not just any green, saturated green. Like, that key lime pie doesn't even look like a key lime pie. It literally looks like a Jell-O pie.
No, it doesn't. Yes, it does.
And it's so green, it may as well be radioactive. Now, that's actually kind of a It's supposed to be indicative. Obviously, you have green with envy, but it's also supposed to kind of represent the poison that lurks within them. There's a lot of green that comes along when they're together throughout their travels, especially with the mass culmination after the snake bites when they go to the pharmacy. And then every light in the pharmacy is just this, it's fluorescent green. And it's dark, sickly, dark green. Yeah.
Green. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's it's one of those aspects of just how hard is Oliver Stone trying to go to prove his point with what he's trying to say with this movie.
I feel he was just as consumed with getting the point across on this movie as he was in JFK. For sure. Just with like the vitriol and the intensity of it all.
So, yeah, I'm not going to, for my own personal cinematic viewing privileges, JFK and Natural Born Killers were my introduction to Oliver Stone.
Oh, nice.
Not going to lie. Probably the two worst ways to be introduced to a director,
for sure,
cinematic work, because one, you have the historical clusterfuck that is the JFK assassination and all of that, and the story that he tried to tell with that and all of that. Then, you know, you follow that up with Natural Born Killers.
Which is
polar opposites.
But they're also, if they are to be such polar opposites, they are so far to the opposite that they almost are closer that way. And the reason that I say that is because JFK is an amalgamation of the reality of history and the assumed reality of some of the conspiracies that had been, you know, promulgated and were popular amongst that time, even up to now. Obviously, it's still an ongoing thing. But at the time that the JFK was put out, working with what he had to work with, it was an amalgamation, a story of of historical events blended in with conspiratorial elements that painted a Rembrandt, if I am to be so bold.
Yeah. Well, no, because I actually like the metaphor that you came up with, where they're so far polar opposite that they almost come back around full circle and meet on the other side of the freaking circle. Because everything about what they're saying speaks to society as a whole in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
And every aspect of the whole JFK story is just as fucked up as every aspect of
NBK.
Natural Born Killer is.
Now, to properly segue back, the question you would ask me was what Oliver's statement was. And that was to point out the disgusting nature of what our society of media had become. Because, I mean, this is just only a few. I mean, I don't even think this was a full decade removed from the advent of like CNN, 24-hour news, breaking news cycles, following high speed chases, you know, the Rodney King beating and all the everything.
So, brief history hiccup. Like, this is 1994 when this came out.
Yeah.
We're talking maybe a year or two since Rodney King and the LA riots.
Yep.
We're talking 3 or 4 years since. And I'm not saying CNN hadn't blown up before, but CNN really came into prominence in like 90, 91,
right?
When Desert Storm went down. and the constant, like, I remember going home after school the day that we invaded Iraq and watching the constant news coverage on CNN over and over and over and over again, because that was, you know, the first real moment of something like that I could remember from my lifetime. Yeah, I was only like 12 years old at the time, but, you know, still.
That's prolific, man.
It is. It's the same. I mean, and it spirals into, you know, right about this time, you have the Oklahoma City bombing. You have, you know, other stuff coming on the horizon. Ultimately, you know, September 11th. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is the dawning. I mean, you also have to remember, too, this is the early days of the internet. So you don't have, you know, X. You don't have the Facebook. You don't have, you know, all the social media, you know, updates and Googles and all of that keeping you updated on your news. Your news that was given to you literally is coming from your local news channels, plus your CNNs and your MSNBCs and your Fox News. And I don't even think there was even really a whole lot of MSNBC and Fox News at this point. Most of your national news coverage all cycled through
local or CNN. Yeah.
Yeah. Local or CNN.
Yep.
So, you know, that's I was just going to say, if you aren't in that age range of myself and Chancey, that kind of sort of gives you some kind of image of what society was like back in the early to mid 90s.
Oh yeah, it was the brand new shiny toy. Like, you got the OJ Simpson car chase, you got the Waco standoff, you got, you know, all of these things that took place before this movie had been released. And all of them were overtly publicized, like, to the point
OJ, we all had to sit there and watch the freaking Bronco chase.
Right.
All night long on TV that night.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Waco standoff. Fuck, that was like 8 days or however long.
Oh, that was like 50 some odd days.
I don't know exactly how long, but, you know, it was a significant period of days that everybody watched that whole situation unfold.
Oh yeah, daily.
Don't get me started on court TV and everybody playing every minute of the OJ Simpson trial on TV for everybody to watch.
And I was also going to comment on, like, you know, A Current Affair, Hard Copy, all those, like, you know, like TMZ before TMZ could TMZ. And all of those things all wrapped up in one.
To a certain extent, you know, we didn't have a whole lot of, like, Inside Edition and all that. I mean, this is all when Inside Edition, Hard Copy, and all that really became prominent. Like,
yeah, those Inside Edition
news, really all we had before that was Entertainment Tonight, and that was more, you know, interviewing celebrities about their movie that was coming out,
right?
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, like
half an hour, you know. But yeah, you really started to get that hard edge cutting hard news stuff around that time.
Oh yeah. And that was the statement that he was making against it, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you can tell, even like when Mickey and Mallory meet, they doll it up like a Leave It to Beaver, I Love Lucy sitcom, with the most horrendous subject matter. And, like, apparently Oliver Stone had to talk Rodney Dangerfield into some of his stuff, because, like, you know, it was...
Rodney Dangerfield, he may not be the most controversial stand-up comic ever, but he's also not the most tame stand-up comic either.
Right. And for him to be like, I don't know, this is kind of fucked up. you know you're on that live wire.
Yeah.
That third rail, so to speak. But it also has that amalgamation of reality and surreality. When he's like yelling at her for trying to go out and do whatever she's doing. And then it goes to that black and white where he's got his hands all up on her. We don't really know if that's actually happening or if that's just in her head.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Mickey shows up with the meats and the, you know, whatnot. And she's all going on like, and there's a lot of stuff that's really subtle too. Cause like, at the very end of that whole thing, before Mickey ends up going to jail for this, for the, you know, situation, there's a joke that's cracked about how the only reason that they had two kids instead of one is because he was drunk and thought that he was in Mallory's room. Behind a laugh track and like outro theme music, but it's like, then they find out that they left and he stole the car and then he goes to jail. And then that whole thing is surreal. But go ahead. I'm sorry. You were going to ready to say something.
Well, no, because that actually kind of sort of segues into my next question. Why is Mallory at her most violent when killing men who sexually pursue her?
Well, I'm not a trained anything, but people who suffer abuse are, you know, they either have an aversion or become hyper, either hypo or hyper. It's either or. Either they refrain from any kind of sexual activity or of any kind, or they're hypersexualized. But then on top of that, you have these scenarios where she then lashes out with bursts of anger. That could be tied into the previous trauma. It could be added by different trauma. Because, I mean, for all intents and purposes, he could have also physically abused her, let alone, like, mentally or sexually or anything like that. But, like, those circumstances could be her imagining that she for all we know, she could have a flashback, and then all of a sudden she then takes back control by killing people. Because the only person that she doesn't ever do that with is Mickey.
Yeah, Mickey is, I guess, for lack of a better term, her safe place.
Which, I mean, like that first quote said, you know, in a dark time, the eyes begin to see.
Yeah. That really wraps up the whole thought process of what this question is trying to scratch the surface on. It's definitely some fucked up shit that obviously has, for lack of a better term, ripped the Band-Aid off and caused this level of fucked up trauma. But yeah. It's definitely blatant. I was just going to say, it's definitely blatantly obvious that Mallory's past has created a trigger that allows her to maniacally, psychotically, have whatever adverb you want to use, go off and do the sick, twisted, and depraved shit that she does for the better part of the entire movie.
Yeah, I mean, the line's never really defined clearly, and that's part of what that's part of the problems that a lot of people have with the film. Because, like, you know, we'll go back to the diner scene at the very beginning. It's a Tuesday afternoon, nothing's going on. Then all of a sudden, people show up, a couple people say things that somebody didn't like, somebody does something that's a little out of pocket, everybody dies. It's just, there's no rev limiter. It's just like 0, 200 back to zero. Okay, let's go. We got to go now. But like, another prevalent outside of the green is the symbology of the snake. Cause I mean,
yeah,
it's everywhere. Like
so many different ways.
The snake helps Mickey escape from prison because it took a swipe at the guard's horse, made him miss the shot. And then their wedding bands, snakes, when they get married on the bridge and the anime, and it goes from, you know, standard cinematography to animation, their blood blends into two snakes as they go into the water.
Yeah.
It's like it's all there, and it's supposed to kind of, I'm not sure if it's supposed to, you know, let me double check my notes here, but I'm not sure if it's supposed to be knowledge or
well, look, I mean, you have the whole, even less mysteriously, the snake bite, you know, metaphorical, quote unquote, abuse.
Well, and also, I forgot to mention, Mickey himself had his own series of horrific offenses from childhood, like watching his father take his life in that field, like that flashbacks with the headless corpse in a chair.
Yeah.
Or just the way his mother treated him in general. It just doesn't make any sense. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Oh, no. You're 100% on point with everything you were saying, though. And the steak metaphor, or snake, not steak, but the snake metaphor is such an all-encompassing metaphor that weaves its way throughout the entire story. You know, you almost can't get through 5 minutes of the movie without finding some kind of weird way that the snake metaphor twists its way into.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, in some way, shape, or form into the story. So.
And I mean, it's almost suiting that we're jumping back and forth like this, because that's exactly how the movie is, too. Because, like, you know, Robert Downey Jr.'s character, the sleazy journalist, is based off of those, like, the people from Hard Copy, Inside Edition, you know, stuff like that, A Current Affair. And it's also based off of an actual person who they never name in the commentaries. The only reason I even know about this is because he's on a docuseries that I watched for being a big time East Coast, like, producer type guy. And same Australian accent, same like kind of hairstyle that Robert Downey Jr. had in the film, and all the whole bit.
By the way, that fucking accent that Robert Downey Jr. has in this movie, oh my fucking God.
Pretty good. I mean, it wasn't bad.
It's something you definitely are not expecting the first time you hear it.
Wayne Guile. Like, he's just ridiculous.
So,
and then, but go ahead.
I'm just going to make a quick link. If any of the listeners don't necessarily know who the actual reporter type person that Robert Downey Jr.'s character is modeled after, you can kind of sort of attest it to being maybe a little similar to like a Geraldo Rivera type character.
Kinda, yeah. Yeah.
So you can make that basis for comparison. So
And then, like, you know, the you know, the romanticized nature of monstrosity today, like, mm-hmm. how, you know, everybody's always, you know, it's never the victims that get any kind of coverage. It's always the perpetrators, and they're blown up and given these names and this, that, and the other. One of the things that people even say in the whole period where it's got the trial and the this and the that, like, they're all like, oh, you know, Mickey and Mallory are so awesome, blah, 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 blah. And somebody's like, so you're all about the accident? Oh, no, no, no. We respect human life, but if I was a killer, I would be Mickey and Mallory.
Well, and you look at, like, the mob scene outside of the courthouse when they're arrested.
Right.
And you've got all these people as the car pulls up, and they're pulled out of the car, and they're celebrating the epic greatness that is Mickey and Mallory. But I mean, at the end of the day, what
was honestly, great?
What is great about these are people that have gone, you know, all over the country, whatever, and killed how many people?
It was like 30 something, I think, or maybe more. And I don't remember the exact number.
You know, not even just, you know, bang, but they ruthlessly kill these people.
Mm-hmm. We didn't even mention the hotel scene.
Oh, God.
I know. I mean, like, I think it's quite fitting, actually, to go from the romanticized public spectacle that they were meant to describe that. Because then they're like, because you asked, well, what's so great about them? Well, how about an example of why they were fucking awful? And I mean, the theatrical version of the hotel scene and the director's edition of the hotel scene are two entirely different fucking things, and they are fucking brutal.
Hashtag, like, probably 30 of the 155 cuts came out of the hotel scene.
I would say 50. I would go with the 55 of the 155 probably came from there. Because, I mean, for those who, you know, for those who don't know, when they get away from the, from one of their capers, they take a hostage, and they're celebrating they're consummating the marriage, so to speak, and come to find out after a little bit of time, which I really
like bunnies.
Yeah, right. But the thing that really threw me was how well of a job that Oliver Stone did hiding the third person in the room with the montage of violence, both in the hotel room and outside the window on the projection screen. Cause you know, you got the fake stuff happening on TV, while in real life you have all the worst things from like the 20th century playing on a projection outside of the window of their hotel room. And
which is fucked up.
And then all of a sudden you find out, oh, they have a hostage. And he's trying to get freaky with the hostage, and she's not about it. So she leaves, and like you were saying, it ties into your original point about her killing people that pursue her, because she then goes and kills the gas station attendant. It's just
so much.
So much. Yeah, and then we're introduced to the detective who's just as fucked up as they are. There really are no heroes in this film.
No, there really isn't, because you would think people that are naturally supposed to be the quote-unquote good guys, they're just as fucked up and twisted as Mickey and Mallory are.
Right? Because he kills that sex worker in order to, like, you know, get into the mindset of the killer and, you know, be able to catch him that way. I think that was a cop-out, because, I mean, that's what came from the commentary, but I really think it was just a cop-out. It was just something to show, because they only had a limited amount of time to show how awful he was before, you know, because you get, this is the setup for justification for him getting his ass kicked and killed in the jail cell later on. That's really what it is.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
I was just going to say, even you would think the media supposed to be, you know, portraying the facts of the story, blah, 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 and all that. Robert Downey Jr. is just as fucking evil and fucking fucked up as everybody else in this movie is, too.
Yep. Everybody's in it for their own interest.
Yeah. Everybody has a selfish means to an end.
That is correct. Yep.
And
go ahead.
Everybody is makes they have to achieve their fucking means to an end.
Mm-hmm. And as we were saying earlier, with the green being the poison that's within them, it just permeates. It gets more and more and more and more and more and more until it finally fully consumes them. One of the things that I thought was something that only a true artisan, if you will, could pull off was making the desert scenes seem claustrophobic.
Yes, and they do too.
Whether they're driving to get away from the policeman or going to the shaman or the medicine man's house, which is funny because the shaman, the guy that played the shaman, was actually a member of the Sioux Nation, but they had him playing a Navajo, which is funny. I mean, it's just like one of those, huh, who'd have thunk it? But,
who'd have thunk it?
And actually, I got to take that back. There is one hero in this film, and that's the medicine man, the shaman. He's the only hero in the entire film. And as they say, no good deed goes unpunished. Because he saw the demons within them when they came into his home. And yeah. The man lived with a rattlesnake. Another insertion of the snake symbolism. And he picks up
the snake.
And I mean, he picks up the snake like it's nothing, and then lets it go, yeah. And then starts this exorcism. Like he knows, he knows about all of this before it happens. Because then he does the ritual to make his grandson into a man. And then he starts before he even starts to do the exorcism, he's talking with the grandson. And he basically talks about, he describes them as being lost in a world of ghosts. And I thought that was very interesting. I thought it was kind of a very profound thing for him to say, because that's true. They are lost in a world of ghosts, either by their own making or the ghosts of nightmares past. Mm-hmm. And during the actual exorcism, you can literally watch their madness spreading through them in a much more rapid pace. And then, the snakes are supposed to represent knowledge. That's what it was. Representations of knowledge. Because the more they're bit, when they, after they end up leaving medicine man's home and they're walking through the Valley of the Snakes, the more they're bit, the more they're supposed to learn, be learning. Because also, we forgot to mention this whole time that they're tripping heavily on mushrooms, hard at this point.
Very hard. Very heavily. Again, that's one of those things that can make the movie kind of difficult for some to watch, possibly. Is I think Oliver Stone did, in my opinion, honestly, a fantastic job of portraying the mind trip of them basically being on fucking hallucinogenics.
Yeah. The introspective portion. Yeah, for sure.
Better part of the whole entire movie.
I'd say that's a good call. Cause yeah, it definitely, especially that part definitely fits the introspective phase when all the, you know, the gigs and the fun stuff becomes normal, then it all kind of goes inward and you start to focus on yourself. But like, just when you think that the shaman's about to pull all the evil out of him, cause you notice that when he's tripping and he's talking to Mallory, his face morphs a little bit before they get to the shaman. I only brought that up because you see it one other time later. Yep. I only brought that up because you see it one other time later. And just when you think that he might actually succeed, Mickey has a nightmare and shoots him in his sleep. And before the Indian dies, he tells him about how 20 years ago he saw the face of the demon and that he had been waiting for them.
Again, deep, deep, deep psychological, thematic. Oh my God. So fucking much.
And then, you know, from that point, they go into the Valley of the Snakes where they're both bitten so many times that they would have probably died by the time they actually reached this pharmacy. And
there probably wasn't even an inch of their bodies that was not covered in fucking snake bites.
If the snakes were even real in the first place, because if you notice, like, again, they're all...
What do you believe? I mean, what is reality and what is freaking hallucination throughout this entire movie?
I know.
Herein lies the fucking beauty of this fucking movie.
And as you know, like I said, you know, they got the green representation of poison and envy. The entire pharmacy is green. Every inch. And she's laying on the floor and she's supposedly dying. And then, hey, the cops are here. And she hops up like nothing's wrong. And, you know,
yeah, exactly.
And so unfolds the scenario, which is like it's a basic replica of the Rodney King beating. And the sensationalized media coverage.
Kind of sort of going through at the time.
Right. And then you got the, it's funny though, because it's not like an American reporter kind of thing. It's a Japanese reporter talking about how, you know, virile he is and whatnot. And then he gets beat down and they're talking about he's been rendered impotent and all this other nonsense. And I wish that they would have put the deleted scene from the trial in the movie, but because they didn't actually show any of the scenes from that specific, you know, death or killing spree, part of the killing spree, and he was also trying to illustrate that they were, you know, getting better, so to speak, he felt that it would have been a regression to have it in there. But I thought it was great because he just kills the shit out of Ashley Judd with that fucking pencil. he just fucking wrecks her. Oh yeah,
yeah.
I forgot that's a deleted scene. Yeah, no, yeah, they actually show, because if I'm not mistaken, like, he defends himself. Mickey defends himself, and he's asking her questions and he approaches her and he just starts fucking stabbing the shit out of her with a pencil. Like, just fucking insanity. But then it cuts. So in the theatrical version, it cuts from the pharmacy to the prison. And you'll notice one thing about the prison, especially when shit starts hitting the fan, you get a lot more of that green popping up. But the prison scenes were actually shot in a real prison in Illinois. And those extras were actual inmates. So that riot was essentially a controlled riot.
I did not know that. Wow. That adds a whole lot more to that story than meets the eye.
And also, at the beginning of there, where they have Tommy Lee Jones and, I loved him so much. He died a little while back. I can't remember the guy that played Scagnetti. I'll remember it in a little bit. It doesn't matter. But the detective and the warden meet up together. And they're talking to each other. And it's at that point you learn that his mother was killed by Charles Whitman, the dude who shot from the clock tower in Texas, which is kind of a little window into the shaping of his own insanity. Sizemore, Tom Sizemore. That's his name.
Oh, yeah. I was Googling it while you were talking. But yeah.
I don't know why, but I was like, I got to hurry. He's looking it up. And my brain was like, Sizemore! His name is fucking Sizemore!
I saw the guy's freaking face literally like right there in the front of my freaking brain, and I'm like, what in the hell, goddamn?
I know, right?
Because, yeah, like literally the last couple years of his fucking life, it was like almost just as fucked up as Mickey and Mallory's story was. Not to the extent that he went around killing people, but.
Well, right, you know, right. The guy had a rough go.
He had his own demons there at the end.
When they get through the walkthrough and get to Mallory's cell, that's actually Juliette Lewis singing. And that was something that she had came up with. And that always stuck out to me. Like, before I even knew that that was actually her or that was something she did, like, for the movie, like, the thing that caught my attention was how beautiful her voice is.
She's a very talented person.
She is. She truly is. Although I do feel bad for the camera guy the camera person, I should say, because when she gets done singing and sees Scagnetti at the window and she charges him head first, an actual camera person ran into like the wall or the door or some plexiglass panel in front of all of it. So they didn't, you know, but basically somebody came out with a black eye because they ran head first into that. That's how they got that shot.
Probably easier to pull off that way than it is to have her do what she would have had to do to pull that off.
Right. And you can't have Mallory get hurt or nothing, because then you can't put off. You can get a new camera person, but you can't get a new Mallory.
Exactly. Like, oh shit, we gotta recast and go back to square one and start all over again. And let's be honest, at the end of the day, I don't think you could have found somebody even remotely close to as perfect for that role as Juliette Lewis was.
I don't even think she would have been as good for the role if she hadn't have already done Cape Fear.
Cape Fear definitely added a whole nother element to her level of talent.
Right. And, you know, you got that prison interview. That whole thing, that's basically stemmed off of the Manson Rivera interviews that Geraldo Rivera did from prison with Manson. And
kind of sort of where I drew the comparison to Gail being your natural born killer version of Geraldo.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And if I'm not mistaken, that headless corpse that I was talking about that Mickey always sees when he has his flashbacks, I believe that was their editor, that they just did a digital removing of his head.
That's fucked up.
Isn't it, though? And then the idea behind the headless man was actually something Oliver Stone saw in a dream. Which, I mean, you know.
How much of this movie was something that, you know, came to Oliver Stone in a fever dream?
And, that's true. That's very, very true. I mean,
at the end of the day, this shit doesn't just naturally pop into somebody's head out of nowhere.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that the scene where they were eating mushrooms, driving, you know, to get away from the policeman stemmed from an actual event where they were looking for a shoot location and Oliver Stone was tripping on mushrooms and there was a car full of people and a cop was following them. And he's just like, turn left here. And then they turned left. And then as soon as they turned left, like he reached over and pushed their foot to the floor and off they went. It's like, you know what, though? I respect the shit out of that because, I mean, you know, that's dedication to your craft, I suppose. But like in that prison interview thing, I love how they kept in the commercials to kind of. Yeah. Lull you into that. It's okay. This is just TV. This isn't real.
Yeah. It definitely creates that level of artistic storytelling that I don't think anybody had ever done to that point.
And one thing I forgot to mention that I have to mention now because we're kind of moving into it and getting towards that rapid descent into madness, as if it wasn't already insane to begin with, you'll notice that Mallory's delusions are in black and white. Mickey's delusions are in living color. Because you'll notice that, like, all the stuff that he remembers, with the exception of the headless man, that usually comes in dream states. But all the other times that he sees, like, you know, when he sees that flash of Robert Downey Jr. as the devil covered in blood, or when he sees himself covered in blood, or any of the other things, when he sees something in black and white, it's a memory, like his mom talking to him or something like that. All the other stuff's in living color. And that. When Robert Downey Jr. is dressed up like the devil covered in blood is basically supposed to be a representation of how not only Mickey sees and perceives, you know, Robert Downey Jr. in the media, but how Oliver Stone takes, you know, how he sees the media as well.
Well, because, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to remember, too, Oliver Stone and his visions and storytelling abilities have not always gotten a fair shake and fair portrayal in the media as well. I mean, Platoon, JFK, Natural Born Killers,
Fourth of July.
Born on the 4th of July, all movies that, as a cinematic, you know, well, cinephile, I would say I enjoyed all of them. But they kind of got harsh treatments in the media.
Oh, yeah. Not every single one of them, but for the most part, a lot of them really did.
Yeah.
Like real bad, except for Platoon. Platoon probably got the best shake, but like Born on the 4th of July Go ahead.
Born on the 4th of July was definitely harsh.
Oh, yeah. It was JFK. Panned. panned.
JFK, big time. And yeah, clearly natural born killers.
It doesn't even deserve a mention, because it's like, inherently this is fucked.
Well, because basically my thought is Natural Born Killers was made so that Oliver Stone literally could kick the media in the dick.
Yep. And I think they all knew that too.
Which is probably a lot of the reason why this movie didn't get as much media love.
Mm-hmm.
As you would think it would have, but you know,
I always thought to myself, you know, who'd have thought you could actually have a controlled riot in a prison? That joke! I love how he starts that whole prison break with a little Johnny joke. Just fucking, oh my goodness! And then he's like, "Well, what were you doing?" And he's like, bro. And then that lady's hiding and shit. He could have just left her alone, but he knew that it was going to be pandemonium once they all left. He's like, ma'am, you're going to have to come back from around there and come over here with us now, please.
Oh my God. There's so much greatness about this fucking movie. There really is. And again, like we kind of sort of discussed it early on in the movie or in the episode, but I feel like I don't want to throw everything in the garbage, but for the sake of the fact that we're over an hour into the episode.
Oh, I'm halfway through my last page. Okay. I was like, oh yeah, we gotta get this one done.
Yeah. Cause I feel like we've got enough of it covered to where we don't have a whole lot left, but at the same time, yeah, I don't know if there's enough to do a part two episode.
Nah, I was gonna say I can cut this down real quick, because I mean, in all honesty, I mean, you got the guy that saves them at the last second in the shower being the dude from the very first scene. There's a cut scene on that. There's a deleted scene where it's supposed to be like he's supposed to be like a guardian angel that basically, you know, makes them pay their penance, but that never gets incorporated. But I love how Robert Downey Jr. gives up his cushy life and professes his love to his side piece, only to learn that it was the only reason she was interested in him, because he had that cushy life. And then he goes into this mental descent. It's literally like he's representative of everyone trying to get on the same page as Mickey and Mallory, and he goes completely batshit fucking crazy trying to get to that level. And then you can also see how reality comes crashing down at the very end. When they're escaped and away from everyone else. And, you know, Robert Downey Jr. realizes that nobody actually cares because helicopters were not deployed and all that other nonsense. And
when they're getting ready to
you
think you're all, you know,
the sense of importance is as inflated as their own sense of ego.
Your self-worth is, you know, so big, but yet at the same time it's like so little, because nobody truly gives a fuck about you, and at the end of the day you are a part of this whole fiasco, and you're about ready to get off because Mickey and Mallory don't give two fucks about you.
Right. And when they take him out and inhale a gunfire, you'll notice that something happens while he's being shot. His face does the demon warp like Mickey's did earlier in the film. Almost as if it was transferred during the riot and they were essentially symbolically killing their demons. And then the last entry that I have in
Oliver Stone saying the media is the demon.
Yep. And then the last entry that I have in my notes is the way that they actually close the film out. And they close the film out with a montage of real news clips. So this whole time they're talking, it's all about news and news coverage, news cycles, this, that, and the other. But then what it leaves us with is the taste of our own reality. Mm-hmm. That was really the
reality. It really is.
That was the chef's kiss for me with it, because it was, it does all of these things as polarizing and insane and hodgepodge and everything you want to describe about how crazy that movie is up to that point. When you get part of the way through those newsreels and you're like, oh shit, that's really the news. Because even like it had been so long since I had watched it last, when I watched it again, and they had that, why can't we all just get along, when Rodney King was trying to stop all the violence, yeah, when the riots were going on, I realized at that point, I was like, oh my God, I forgot that he put all that real news footage into this thing.
And it really helps to drive his ultimate point home.
Yeah.
The entire movie.
And so ends my 4 pages of notes.
So I'm going to 100% pose 2 questions as we segue into our review portion of the show.
Yes.
And it's probably the most fitting that these 2 questions get fitted into the review portion of the show. But what does Chance the Rapper love about Natural Born Killers, and what do you not like about Natural Born Killers? Prefaced with a, what would you give this movie on a scale of 1 to 5?
Okay, so my rating out of 5 would be 4.875. Like, I would say as close to 4.9 as I can get it, because I know 5s are real, real hard to give out. But I am speaking specifically about the director's cut. I am solely speaking about the director's cut. And that segues. The director's
cut is,
it's exquisite.
The theatrical release is a great movie, but the director's cut only adds every element of color to the movie that got taken out in the theatrical cut as well.
And it also adds the important context as well, because that was going to segue into what I didn't like about the movie. And what I don't like about the movie is how much less the movie makes sense if you only watch the theatrical version. When I first started watching it, before I got into movies, you know, like in the technical aspect of it, uh-huh, I wasn't a big fan of this movie, because it just didn't make any sense at all. And then
155 things got cut out of the fucking movie.
Exactly. And then you learn that. And then you see it put together like it was supposed to be presented initially. And you're like, oh my God, this makes perfect sense now. This is a great film. I honestly think that this should definitely go on that list of, you know, cinematic experiences that need to be experienced once in your life, for sure. And as far as what I like about the thing, I'm going to go with yes for the director's cut. I mean, I like everything about it. I like how it doesn't give up any element of storytelling to make up for the pacing issues or any of that extra stuff. I love how it fits together the way that it fits together, because it literally, it's like this thing I saw the other day. It's like 100% perfection, CNC machined piece of block steel. And when you put it together, there are no seams. And when you have this director's cut and you watch it from start to finish, you see there are no longer any seams to this that you can pull on to make it go just, oh, this is why it's a stupid movie.
Yeah. The director's cut definitely melds everything back together, because at the end of the day, having to cut 155 things out of a movie is not an easy task to have to undertake.
And then have that.
Because it's going to affect the flow of your movie
Right.
So you cannot, I don't care who you are. I don't care how good of a director. I don't care if you're fucking Steven Spielberg. You cannot cut 155 things out of your movie and still
have it make sense.
A cohesive story.
Exactly. 110%. So, couldn't agree more.
Definitely. Chansey and I are 100% recommending you have to check out the director's cut of this movie. The theatrical version, like Chansey said, it can be harder to follow and it doesn't have that natural flow to it. But definitely watching the theatrical version brings it all back into focus and makes it that much more easier to understand. I love this movie. It's creative. It's artistic. It's fucking Woody Harrelson is a phenomenal fucking actor. And I couple this and People versus Larry Flint, both of which came out right about the same time. Oh, the performance he gave in that movie as Larry Flint. And I'm not even going to lie, too. At the same time, you have the other side of the coin. The performance that Courtney Love gave as his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who knows me knows I am not a huge Courtney Love fan by any stretch of the imagination. But
I could tell that it took a lot out of you to get that out.
It really does. But that performance that she gave in that movie was
great.
Amazing. Probably because it may or may not have leaned a little too hard on her own personal reality, but I'm not judging.
Right.
Juliette Lewis is a phenomenal actress as well. She gave an amazing performance in this movie. The supporting cast alone, top to bottom, is second to none. The music is incredible. The style is incredible. I give the movie a 4.8 out of 5 because, again, I can't go 5. And at the same time, director's cut leans it closer to, 4.9. But then if you consider what the director or what the theatrical cut does, that kind of pulls it back a little bit from that 4.9. So
I'm with you. We'll
go 4.8. So
I am 100% with you on that one.
Definitely, though, a chef's kiss fucking movie, whether you're an Oliver Stone fan or not, I highly recommend you go check this movie out. So before we get out of here, though, obviously, as Chansey knows, each and every week, though, we have to thank the listeners for being here. You guys are incredibly, incredibly awesome. And you guys are the reason that we keep coming back and doing this each and every week. As for where can the listeners find the wonderment that is Chansey Greif, if they are so willing and inclined to need to find you on the socials?
Well, on Instagram and on TikTok, it's the Red Eye Roundtable. On X, it's Red Eye Table. if you can find me on Facebook, that's my actual first name down there. Good luck. It's a real difficult find. But if you can do it, good on you. But, outside of that, I'm cooking up a something.
It's a spicy meatball. It actually kind of is.
Kind of. Now that you mentioned that, I was like, that actually does. Yeah, he's not wrong.
Or But definitely you will have to stay tuned for updates as to what this spicy meatball is. And we will definitely keep the listeners updated as we get closer and closer to this unveiling. I'm trying to think where, okay, so where this is going to fall in the release order of things. We've got A Few Good Men coming up with myself and Amanda, as well as a planned supplemental episode where we are supposed to be joined by her father, who will be making his An Evening at the Movies debut as well.
Nice.
So stay tuned for that. I am excited for those episodes. We've got Kendra's birthday episode coming up here in the next week or two, where she and Amanda and myself will be sitting down and discussing the perks of being a wallflower.
Oh, it's such a good movie too. Nice.
So definitely we are ready to celebrate Kendra and the wonderment that is her birthday. So tune in for that as well. Other than that, we've got superhero movies coming up next month. And then we've got the summer of 1984 coming up this summer as well. So stay tuned for all of that. But you can find us on all the social medias. And as you guys all know, obviously, An Evening at the Movies drops each and every Wednesday morning. And until further notice, we'll be dropping 2 episodes a week. So you have plenty of stuff to be listening to and staying engaged with us. So there is all of that. Thank you, sir, for being here and being willing to sit down and discuss Natural Born Killers with me.
Thank you for letting me be so long-winded.
Oh, no. I thoroughly loved it because I feel like your sick, twisted mind brings a whole another level of horseshit but fuckery to and analyze the wonderment that is the love story that is Mickey and Mallory Knox.
Right.
So, great episode. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you, Chansey, for being here. And at the end of the day, as always, because Amanda's not here and I'm tired of doing her work for her, we hope you guys all come back for An Evening at the Movies. Have a good week, guys. We'll see you next week.